From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
The cuts we've heard from the House of Representatives regarding public broadcasting are about 45% reduction in our funds. That would be devastating to KCBT. It would even be worse to all those stations serving rural areas where some of them might go off the air.
Corporation for Public Broadcasting in the Crosshairs says an investigation is underway into the money and person paid to politically monitor Bill Moyer's program on PBS. The House Appropriations Committee is set to vote on whether to slash $100 million in CPB funding, the first step towards zeroing out the budget. Then we'll take a look at the crackdown on dissent in Ethiopia.
Just a month ago, Ethiopia held the most democratic elections in the country's long history. But over the course of the past week, a government crackdown on opposition protests about the results of those elections have turned very brutal, with at least 37 protesters being gunned down in the streets and thousands of people being arrested and taken to nobody knows where.
And anti-Castro Cuban Luis Posada Carriles remains in U.S. custody. The Venezuelan government officially requested his extradition yesterday as newly released documents shed more light on his role in the 1976 bombing of a Cuban airplane, killing 73 people. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The New York Times is reporting today investigators at the Corporation for Public Broadcasting are examining more than $14,000 in payments made under contract to a man who compiled reports on the political views and backgrounds of guests appearing on the PBS program Now with Bill Moyers. The paper says the CPB's chair, Kenneth Tomlinson, took the unusual step of signing the contracts personally. The inspector general is looking at the contracts signed by Tomlinson with a man named Fred Mann to monitor the political leanings of Now. Mann was listed in the contracts as living in Indianapolis, and officials at CPB said they knew nothing about him. The inquiry was requested by two Democrats, Representatives John Dingell of Michigan, David Obie of Wisconsin, after they learned about the monitoring. The inspector general is also investigating $15,000 in payments to two Republican lobbyists last year that were not disclosed to the CPB board. The New York Times says one of the lobbyists was retained at the direction of Tomlinson and the other at the suggestion of his Republican predecessor, who remains on the board. Today on Capitol Hill, Representative John Conyers is convening a public hearing on the Downing Street memo and other recently released British documents he says confirm the Bush administration manipulated intelligence and facts to justify the invasion and occupation of Iraq. Among those testifying are former U.S. Ambassador to Iraq Joe Wilson and longtime CIA analyst Ray McGovern. Conyers says every major news network is sending cameras except Fox News. Immediately following the hearing, there will be a mass rally across the street from the White House. Conyers will deliver a petition signed by more than 500,000 people calling on President Bush to answer questions on the documents. Amid growing calls for the Guantanamo prison camp to be shut down, the Senate Judiciary Committee has recommended Congress intervene to resolve the fate of the more than 500 prisoners. In a heated hearing on Wednesday, lawmakers sparred with each other and Justice Department officials who asserted that Washington could hold prisoners for the rest of their lives if it wished. Alabama Republican Senator Jeff Sessions argued some of the prisoners, quote, need to be executed, while Democrat Patrick Leahy of Vermont called the prison a, quote, international embarrassment.
Let's get real. These people have been locked up for 3 years, no end in sight, and no process to lead us out of there. Guantanamo Bay is causing immeasurable damage to our reputation as a defender of democracy and a beacon of human rights around the world. I'm proud of what our nation has accomplished. I want us to be that beacon of human rights, but we're not being it with Guantanamo.
Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont. Meanwhile, Dick Durbin, the number two Democrat in the Senate, is under fire for comments he made earlier this week on the Senate floor blasting the conduct of U.S. forces at Guantanamo. Durbin quoted from an FBI agent's report describing prisoners being chained to the floor without food or water in extreme temperatures. Durbin said, quote, "If I read this to you and did not tell you that it was an FBI agent describing what Americans had done to prisoners in their control, you would most certainly believe this must have been done by Nazis, Soviets in their gulags, or some mad regime, Pol Pot or others, that had no concern for human beings," unquote. Republicans have called on Durbin to apologize for the comments. But last night, Durbin released a statement saying, quote, "This administration should apologize to the American people for abandoning the Geneva Conventions and authorizing torture techniques that put our troops at risk and make Americans less secure." ABC News is reporting the interrogation techniques used at Guantanamo in 2002 triggered concerns among senior Pentagon officials that they could face criminal prosecution under U.S. anti-torture laws. ABC obtained notes from a series of meetings at the Pentagon in early 2003 showing that Alberto Mora, general counsel of the Navy, warned his superiors they might be breaking the law. During a January 2003 meeting involving top Pentagon lawyer William Haynes and other officials, the memo shows that Mora warned that the, quote, "use of coercive techniques has military, legal, and political implication, has international implication, and exposes us to liability and criminal prosecution." Mora's concerns about interrogations at Guantanamo have been known, but not his warning that top officials could go to prison. In another meeting held March 8, 2003, the group of top Pentagon lawyers concluded, quote, "We need a presidential letter approving the use of controversial interrogation to cover those who may be called upon to use them." No such letter was issued. The House of Representatives voted Wednesday to block the Justice Department and the FBI from using the USA Patriot Act to obtain library records and bookstore sales slips. The vote reversed a narrow loss last year. It still would allow the government to continue to seek out records of internet use at libraries. 38 Republicans joined with Democrats in the vote. President Bush has threatened to veto any bill that bars the government from going after library and bookstore records. Many librarians have defied the government by disposing of records quickly in an effort to protect people's privacy. Meanwhile, U.S. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez has announced Washington had agreed to delay plans requiring 27 countries to place computer chips in their passports as a prerequisite for allowing their citizens into the U.S. without a visa. Washington had said that all European Union passports issued after October 26 must have biometric security elements, fingerprints, and iris scan included on a microchip, or passport holders will require a visa to enter the U.S. Gonzalez made the announcement in Europe, where he's attending the G8 meeting of ministers. He did not say how much extra time countries will be given. The Venezuelan government has formally requested the extradition of the Cuban-born anti-Castro militant Luis Posada Carriles for his alleged role in the 1976 airliner bombing that killed 73 people. Posada was arrested in Miami last month, has been held in a U.S. detention center in El Paso, Texas, since then. He faces charges of illegal migration. At a hearing Monday in El Paso, Texas, where Posada is being held, his lawyer asked that the immigration case be moved to Florida. The Venezuelan requests asked that the extradition request take precedence over the immigration charges. We'll have more on this story later in the program. Reuters news agency is reporting that Haiti's undemocratically appointed Justice Minister Bernard Gosse, will submit his resignation this week amid growing outrage over the continued imprisonment of the country's democratically elected Prime Minister, Yvonne Neptune. He's been in jail for nearly a year. The New York Times is reporting the NAACP is preparing to appoint a retired executive from Verizon as its new head. It is the first time in decades that the nation's largest civil rights organization is not tapping a politician or minister. Bruce Gordon is to succeed Kwasi Mfume as the president and chief executive of the NAACP. The official announcement is set for later this month. The presidents of five major national labor unions, representing about a third of U.S. union members, formed a new coalition in a move widely seen as the first step toward breaking with the powerful AFL-CIO. Four of the five union leaders have openly discussed leaving the larger body. The group includes some of the labor's most successful unions and represents 5 million workers. The House of Representatives voted down an amendment Wednesday that would have placed a one-year moratorium on federal raids against medical marijuana patients. Even though the measure was defeated, supporters of medical marijuana pointed out that a record 161 Congress members voted to stop arresting medical marijuana patients. The medical marijuana issue reached a head last week when the Supreme Court ruled 6-3 that the federal government has the constitutional authority to arrest medical marijuana patients, even in states which permit medical use. And Television Week is reporting Fox News Channel has signed General Wesley Clark, the former NATO Supreme Allied Commander, CNN contributor, and 2004 Democratic presidential candidate, as a military and foreign affairs analyst. Clark oversaw the 78-day bombing of Yugoslavia in 1999, where, among other actions, he ordered the bombing of Serb television, RTS, killing 16 media workers.
Breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is a gentrification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. ABC, Disney, NBC, GE, Murdoch is Foxy, and with a hint, he owns a pen, the camera, the sword, buy a Coke, buy a Ford, getting broke, getting bored.
And experience your psychic connection.
We don't have shit to say. We don't have anything to do.
What we want, what we need, what we want, what we need. But do we even know who plans to see? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them. They're just selling fruit. Flim flam diagram, data jam, handicap, caught it. Yo, you bought it. My mind is a profitable thing to waste. You want another taste, baby? Got news goo.
What we need to know.
News goo.
What we want to know.
News goo.
What we think we know.
Got remote control to choose a show. But the more we watch, the less we know. Ignorance grows on the spirit like a tumor.
Till freedom is a rumor.
Elvis Presley.
O.J. Simpson abandoned babies.
Order now.
So where's the news of the people left out? Put a camera in my face just to hear me shout. But they don't want to hear what I shout about.
News Goo by Polarity One here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn to the continuing fight over public broadcasting in this country. Today, the House Appropriations Committee is scheduled to vote on drastic cuts to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and to PBS stations. CPB is a U.S. taxpayer-funded agency that funds public media in this country. The proposal to cut funding was authored by Ohio Republican Congressmember Ralph Regan. Would eliminate $100 million in federal funding to PBS stations and cut federal funding to the CPB by 25%. Regula's proposal also calls for all federal funding for PBS to be eliminated in 2 years. A House Appropriations Subcommittee already approved the bill last Thursday. The Association of Public Television Stations has termed the cuts, quote, so drastic they will severely impact every public television and radio station's ability to provide educational, cultural, and informational programming in local communities and throughout the nation. Congressmember Regula has defended the cuts as necessary to avoid reductions in federal support for vocational education, job, and medical training. Also last week, it was reported that a former co-chair of the Republican National Committee is the leading candidate to take over the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Patricia DeStacy Harrison is reportedly the favored candidate of the CPB's Republican chair, Kenneth Tomlinson. Harrison is currently a high-ranking official of the State Department. She was co-chair of the Republican National Committee from 1997 to 2001, helping to raise money for Republican candidates, including George W. Bush. We're joined on the phone right now by Bill Reed, president of KCPT, which is public television station in Kansas City, Missouri. We're also joined on the phone by Trina Cutter. She's president and general manager of the PBS 45 and 49 in Ohio. And on the phone from Fort Worth, Texas, Jeff Chester, executive director of the Center for Digital Democracy. First, let's start off with Jeff Chester. Can you first just give us the details of what is going to be voted on today? Exactly what is being considered for the cutting board?
You're totally garbled. I can't understand anything you're saying.
Sorry, we'll give it a try. Can you hear me right now?
This is Jeff Chester. Today, the Republicans in the House Appropriations Committee are going to send another message to public broadcasting saying, you better stay in line. I mean, there are serious cutbacks proposed, although they're unlikely to ultimately pass the Congress in the way the Republicans have in mind. But this is part of a strategy on the part of the GOP to tame PBS in particular, and to send a message as it's searching for a new president of PBS that you better play along with us.
Bill Reed is with us, president of KCPT in Kansas City. Can you talk about the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and how it has come so directly in the crosshairs and what exactly is being threatened today?
This line is something's wrong because
We'll try to correct it right now. Again, Bill Reed is president of KCPT in Kansas City. He's been president there for 13 years. Can you hear me now?
No, your voice keeps repeating and talking over yourself.
Okay. We're going to go to a break. We'll clear up the lines, and then we'll have you back all on. Thanks very much. We're talking to Trina Cutter, President General Manager of PBS 45 and 49, which serves Northeastern Ohio, Jeffrey Chester, Executive Director of the Center for Digital Democracy, as well as Bill Reed, President of KCPD. Please bear with us.
Las blancas azucenas, los nardos y las rosas, mi alma muy triste y pesarosa, a las flores quiere ocultar amargo dolor. Yo no quiero que las flores sepan los tormentos que me da la si supiera lo que estoy sufriendo por mis penas llorarían
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Sorry for the technical problems. We're going to go back to that discussion. But first, we're joined by a live guest on an entirely different issue. Then we'll talk about the threat to Corporation for Public Broadcasting. We're going to talk about Ethiopia right now. The Ethiopian government is cracking down on protests against possible fraud in the May 15th parliamentary elections. Human Rights Watch reported yesterday that police have arrested several thousand people in the capital and nine other cities. Last Wednesday, government security forces responded to rock-throwing protesters by opening fire on large crowds, killing at least 36 people and wounding more than 100. The Ethiopian government blames the opposition group Coalition for Unity and Democracy for fomenting the unrest. The prime minister justified the decision to monitor opposition leaders.
When these people incited the violence and had their tickets ready to leave the country, that I think is stretching it a bit too far. So we have said, you're not leaving while you are inciting violence and stoking fires here. They have been under police surveillance. Just in case we need to detain them. If things get hotter, they will be detained without any question. If that is intimidation, so be it. But I think we have bent back more than any country that I know of would be willing to do.
That was Ethiopian Prime Minister Meles Zenawi speaking to a journalist on Friday. On Sunday, police shot dead newly elected opposition lawmaker Tesfaye Adinjara. Officials said six police officers have been arrested in connection with the killing. The European Union mediated an agreement Tuesday between the main political parties so that all parties can play a role in the investigation of election complaints. Following the agreement, opposition leader Haile Choel was released from house arrest. We're joined now to talk about the crackdown on dissent by Human Rights Watch researcher Chris Albanlaki. He was in Ethiopia leading up to the May 15th elections. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thanks.
Can you talk about the situation? What's happening?
Well, what's really terrible about what's going on in Ethiopia right now is that these elections were regarded by almost everyone as a watershed event in the country's history. They were by far the most open and competitive poll the country's ever seen. In fact, they were the only open and competitive poll Ethiopia's ever had. But the events of the past week give reason to doubt that, in fact, Ethiopia is moving down the path to democracy to the degree that many people thought the elections indicated. What's perhaps even more disturbing than the shooting down of the 37 protesters and the wounding of 100 more and the arrests of all of these people is the government's contemptuous reaction to the international outcry these events have sparked. The government has until now refused even to consider an inquiry into the events and in fact has responded to any suggestions that its security forces might in any way be to blame by simply blaming the leaders of the opposition for everything that's happened.
So who has been arrested? Who has been killed?
Well, early last week, hundreds of student protesters were arrested in Addis Ababa, and hundreds more were arrested in other towns throughout the country. Many of those were since released, but since then the government has continued to target opposition supporters and student activists in Addis Ababa and elsewhere for arrest. Many people in Addis Ababa have simply disappeared, and people assume that they've been arrested and taken to detention facilities outside of the capital, but no one really knows how many people have been arrested, who they are, why they're being held, or how they're being treated in custody.
Does this tie in at all to the situation between Ethiopia and Eritrea?
Well, it has implications for it. The opposition coalition that did so well in these elections actually takes a very hard line on the issue of the border dispute with Eritrea. And many people worry that their presence in the parliament may actually cause the government to feel as though it has to take a harder line with Eritrea.
What do you think needs to be done now?
Well, the Ethiopian government, first of all, needs to stop arresting opposition supporters and student activists. Perhaps more urgently, it has to open up these detention centers, especially a massive facility south of Addis Ababa called Zawai Detention Center, to international scrutiny. Up until now, the Red Cross hasn't even been able to gain access to any of these facilities. And given the government's past record of detainee abuse, there's every reason to worry that many of the people being held right now are being mistreated.
We're talking about the situation now in Ethiopia. Could any of this been predicted before the elections?
Nobody's been able to predict anything that's happened since the elections. Even the degree to which the elections were positive and open and competitive, no one predicted. Certainly, though, the events of the past week, I think, have really shocked almost everyone who's been following Ethiopia over the course of the past several months. There was a lot of optimism following the May 15th elections that they really did mark a new beginning for this government, that it perhaps was an indication that the government wanted to try to become more serious about making real the kind of democratic rhetoric that it's always coming out with. But certainly, everything that's happened over the past week seems to point in the opposite direction.
Can you tell us a little more about the Prime Minister, Mela Sanawi?
Prime Minister Meles came to power after leading a long guerrilla struggle against his predecessor, who Mengistu Haile Mariam, who was a brutal military dictator. He was, when he came to power, and still is by most of the world, regarded as one of the most progressive leaders on the African continent. He has become the most prominent face of the United Kingdom's Commission for Africa, which is trying to advance a bold new agenda for development on the African continent. His country also has benefited from enormous amounts of international aid and relatively little in the way of international criticism and scrutiny, largely because of Prime Minister Meles's reputation. It seems as though he may have done a lot to tarnish that reputation over the course of the past week. But to be honest, the international community's relationship with his government has always been characterized by lack of meaningful criticism, and it remains to be seen whether anything's going to change in the long term because of all of this.
And the opposition leader, Haile Schwa, who was released from house arrest, who is he?
The opposition coalition, the CUD, represents primarily the Amhara ethnic group in Ethiopia, which up until the current government came to power has been dominant in Ethiopia for centuries. The emergence of this coalition signifies a resurgence of Amhara nationalism in Ethiopian politics. What's worrying about the political picture now is that many of Ethiopia's other ethnic groups continue to remain without a voice in the political system. And if these elections are really to be meaningful in the long term, the government is going to have to continue to open up the political space to other voices.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us, Chris Alban-Lackey, researcher at the Africa Division of Human Rights Watch, spent a month in Ethiopia leading up to the parliamentary elections. As we stay with Africa right now, we are going to turn now to South African poet and activist Dennis Brutus. In apartheid South Africa, Dennis Brutus was an outspoken activist against the state. He helped secure South Africa's suspension from the Olympics, eventually forcing the country to be expelled from the Games in 1970. He was arrested in 1963, sentenced to 18 months of hard labor in Robben Island off Cape Town with Nelson Mandela. Brutus was banned from teaching, writing, and publishing in South Africa. His first collection of poetry, Sirens, Knuckles, and Boots, was published in Nigeria while he was still in prison. After he was released, Dennis Brutus fled South Africa on a Rhodesian passport. In 83, after a protracted legal struggle, he won the right to stay in the United States as a political refugee, where he's now a professor at the University of Pittsburgh. Dennis Brutus recently initiated the launch of a campaign against Barclays Bank, demanding reparations for vast apartheid profits. He joined us in our studio last week, and I began by asking him to talk about this most recent campaign.
We've just kicked it off, Amy, and we're taking on the banks, essentially, and mainly Barclays Bank, which funded the apartheid regime.
This is Barclays?
Yes, and they also, of course, made a lot of money out of it. Now, surprisingly, they're planning to come back to South Africa and purchase the biggest retail bank in the country, which is called Absa. So we're organizing a protest. We've got pickets out there already saying Barclays is not welcome because they were the allies of the apartheid system.
In what way did they support the apartheid system, and were they kicked out?
Right. Firstly, they made formal kind of statements, but in addition, they purchased 10 million rand of bonds, which were support of the Defense Department. And they accompanied with a statement from the bank CEO saying, this is a sign of our support for the system and the kind of good citizen approach. So their record is very clear. Now they're coming back again. And this time they would purchase the biggest retail bank and, in fact, interact with the people and profit from this new, what we call economic apartheid, as distinct from the old racial apartheid, because the wealth is still in the hands of a minority. Although it's true that a few blacks have now been allowed to become members of the board of De Beers Diamond Mine or Anglo-American, the big gold mining corporation. So it's not an exclusively white system as it used to be under apartheid. But for the mass of the people, there's still poverty. They're still living in shacks in the townships.
There was a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. It involved people who were involved with the torture and killing of others under apartheid. And also, there was an aspect of it that was about corporate responsibility. What came of that aspect, and were reparations ever paid?
Yes and no, because the legislation which created the Truth and Reconciliation Commission had a provision for reparations. But most of the people who were the victims of apartheid did not get any of that reparations. The corporations, you're right, were supposed to contribute to a fund and contributed about 1%, but it was minimal. And in fact, the mass of the people still have not received reparations, which is why we've filed for reparations in the New York Supreme Court, where we, being Jubilee South Africa and an organization called Kulumane, which is the victims of apartheid, and between the two of them, we have filed in New York applying for reparations. So far, we've not received. Most of the people who were the victims of apartheid have not received reparations. So, one, we continue that particular lawsuit, but in addition, we've made a direct demand to Barclays saying, if you do not apologize, if you do not pay reparations, you are not welcome in South Africa. Now, the important thing here is that Barclays is operating in more than 80 countries all over the world. So when we organize a protest against Barclays, we intend to make it happen not merely in South Africa, but to coordinate it with action in all the other countries where Barclays is active. So we can pretty much globalize our protest. If we're facing globalized oppression in our time through the corporations, we think we can now develop a globalized protest as well.
Talking about reparations, talking about apartheid, you, Dennis Brutus, spent time with Nelson Mandela on Robben Island. You were imprisoned, broke rocks together.
That's right.
You have seen the latest news of President Mandela coming to the United States, the former president of South Africa. He met with President Bush. Your thoughts on this? I know there was some concern among activist groups to give President Bush
There's a very striking difference between the Mandela, who was quite blunt in his criticism, not only of the U.S. entry into Iraq, but also the election itself. So we had some very frank speaking at that time. And surprisingly, now we find Mandela visiting with President Bush and saying, oh, well, friends have this way of criticizing each other. So in a sense, he's climbing down from his previous criticism. And I suppose the explanation is that when he came to the United States, it was mainly in order to raise funds for one of the Mandela foundations. So it seems to me being very polite, I would say excessively polite, and indeed for people who knew him as someone who spoke out bluntly, this is not only a surprise, it's also a disappointment. We think he should have maintained his position.
Well, what about Mandela's power today and President Bush's relationship with him and the current president of South Africa, Thabo Mbeki?
Generally, Mandela has chosen to take the role of an elder statesman and to be fairly soft-spoken. On the other hand, as we know, that George Bush has been very cordial towards Thabo Mbeki, the new president, and indeed has called Mbeki his point man in Africa when it comes to questions like Zimbabwe. So there's a much warmer relationship between Thabo Mbeki and President Bush. Mandela was rather more distant, so it's a little surprising that he's now being more cordial. And as I say, the explanation is probably that he came on an enormous fundraising venture, met with some of the big corporations, especially the arms industry, and that explains the change, I suppose.
We're talking to Dennis Brutus. He has a latest book, a collection of his poems called Leaf Drift. Some of these poems were written under a pseudonym, some when you were in prison. Can you talk about them and share one with us?
Well, yes, you're right. Some of them were written when it was a crime for me to publish.
Why a crime?
Others were smuggled while I was on Robben Island, smuggled out of the prison. But in fact, most of this is new and deals, in fact, with a new South African situation where, surprisingly, we come out of apartheid into global apartheid. We're in a world now where, in fact, wealth is concentrated in the hands of a few. The mass of the people are still poor. According to the World Bank itself, there are literally millions now below the poverty line, so that the situation is actually deteriorating. And this is quite striking in South Africa. As water is privatized, as electricity is privatized, as people are evicted even from their shacks because they can't afford to pay the rent of the shacks, the situation becomes worse. And it seems to me at the heart of the matter is the fact that the South African government under the ANC and Mbeki have chosen to adopt the corporate solution. They say, oh, globalization is inevitable. And we think that's not true. You can have a globalizing process which takes care of the people's interests, or you can have
How?
A globalizing process which instead focuses on the corporations. You give tax reductions to the rich. You increase the tax on bread and sugar and coffee and tea and petrol, gas for cars, because these things affect the poor. On the other hand, you are actually cutting the taxes on luxury goods so that, in fact, your whole society is geared to keep the corporations happy and allow them actually to go offshore so they don't even have to pay tax. They can pay tax in the Cayman Islands or the Bahamas or somewhere. But a society which is geared to protect the rich and the corporations and actually is hammering the poor, increasing their burden, this is the reverse of what we thought was going to happen under the ANC government.
A poem from Leaf Drift. Could you share with us?
Right. I think it would be appropriate to read a poem which is actually about our current protest. You may know, and I think you covered it on Democracy Now, when we were marching against Kofi Annan and Colin Powell and the World Summit on Sustainable Development, people were marching from the ghettos, from the townships, to this expensive suburb called Sandton, where you had this enormous expense, you know, lavish expenditure, and talk about making the world a better place, when in fact the world was becoming a worse place. So we have a poem about it, and I'm going to read that, which is just about the march. When we marched, slithered through slimy mud, past riot-shielded cops in Alexander, this is the ghetto, while children peered wild-eyed from dark windows. For some of us, these were reruns of earlier apartheid-burdened days. But then it was defiant resolution that drove our hearts and braced our feet. Now sadness at betrayal sat sadly on our hearts. Our shouted slogans hung heavy over us in grimy air. We winced at familiar, oft-repeated lies. oft repeated lies.
Dennis Brutus reading from his latest collection of poetry called Leaf Drift. Why Leaf Drift?
Well, I know people have been a little puzzled, and my own sense is that I was unable to find a single unifying theme. So the image that came to me was more of leaves blowing around in the wind and then accumulating in a corner, kind of drifting together. So it's a random collection. Some of it is personal, some of it is political. I think leaf drift is a good word, which gathers that sense of things together.
As you look back over your 80 years, your own personal, as well as the state of the world, and you look ahead, do you feel like society, civilization is advancing?
Advancing, I'm not sure, but I have a sense of gathering energy and a kind of will for change, almost as if people are saying, this is intolerable. We've allowed it to go on for too long. When I'm in Porto Alegre at the World Social Forum, or I'm in Lusaka at the African Social Forum, or meeting in Mpumalanga and Soweto, the ghettos of South Africa, such an impatience, particularly among young people, saying the world must change. There really ought to be a greater emphasis on humane values. This nonsense about hanging around in the shopping malls, you know, and competing for Nike or whatever. This is nonsense. We have to get over it. Humanity is about more than material things. And we really must shake off this kind of mystification, the way we've been caught up in a set of lies and deceptions, and we must try and recover our own humanity. So I'm very hopeful.
South African poet Dennis Brutus. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back, we'll look at media reform. Stay with us.
Don't. Here's what I want you all to do for me.
Bang! Caught you looking for the same thing. It's a new thing. Check out this I bring. Uh-oh, the road below the level, cause I'm living low next to the base.
Come on!
Turn up the radio. They're claiming I'm a criminal. But now I wonder how, some people never know. The enemy could be their friend guardian. I'm now a hooligan, I rock the party and clear all the madness. I'm not a racist, preach to teach the
all. Cause don't they never have this?
Number one, never wanna run about the gun. I wasn't licensed to have one. The minute they see me, fear me. I'm the epitome, a public enemy. Used, abused, without clues. I refuse to blow a fuse. They even had it on the news.
Don't believe the hype.
Was the start of my last jam, so here it is again, another death jam. But since I gave you all a little something that I knew you liked.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. That was Public Enemy. I'm Amy Goodman. As we talk about public media, again, the latest headlines, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the Crosshairs, the House Appropriation Committee is scheduled today to vote on drastic cuts to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the U.S. taxpayer-funded agency that funds public media in this country, part of a major assault on public media that's intensified significantly in the second term of the Bush administration. We apologize for the technical difficulties earlier. We're having trouble with our phone system, so we're going to return to our guests tomorrow. But right now, we're going to play excerpts of the opening session of the National Conference on Media Reform that recently took place in St. Louis. We're going to go first to Janine Jackson, the Program Director of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting.
The recognition that we all share, that information is a public good and not a commodity, has a history. The work we're doing now stands on the shoulders of a lot of people whose names we don't know and some whose names we may, like Liebling, Sinclair Lewis, I.F. Stone, George Seldes. But a lot has changed. I think we are in a special moment right now, and a lot has certainly changed since FAIR was founded in 1986. Back then, and I think what's changed is most significantly in people's heads, as Bob has started to say. Back then, as long ago as 1986, a lot of smart, politically active people thought of media as an ancillary issue. There was bad coverage, certainly, of this or that issue, but the media system itself was not considered a sort of contestable terrain. I think there may have been an implicit sense that better media might flow naturally from some of the other social and economic goals that we wanted to achieve. That has changed now. People think differently about media now. Remember how when you used to complain about something you saw on television or heard on the radio, people, even people who agreed with you, would tell you to just turn it off. You don't hear that so much anymore. It's increasingly come to sound as odd as telling someone who's concerned about polluted air, well, just stay inside. The impact and influence of media is undeniable. What's more, we no longer talk about media as a kind of corporate noblesse oblige. You know, it's this magic stuff. We don't even pay for it. You just turn on the TV and there it is. Isn't that wonderful? It's no longer seen as a kind of private enterprise where the public has no standing, if you will, no right to demand accountability or redress. Media is a political issue. And not just that, but it's understood as a keystone issue, like a keystone species, something that is critically affects virtually everything else that we care about. To make change, I think people both need to see that something is wrong and feel that they can do something about it. And I think we're at that point now with media. And we really should take a moment, metaphorically speaking, to appreciate the sea change and the victory that that really represents. Sure, why not? It is a big deal. But I think we also need to appreciate the victories along the way. If you ever fought for a television show to get on the air or stay on the air, if you wrote an opinion column or a letter to the editor, that's ideas that you put in somebody's head that they might not have had otherwise, and that matters. But now we've got people talking about media reform. What I really want to say is now we've won that part. We've got people talking about media reform. As we go forward, we need to keep asking ourselves, media reform for what? Do we want to break up dominant media conglomerations because it just sort of sounds better that there be like a smaller number of companies? No, it's not that. It's not an academic exercise. Media reform is not academic. Bad media hurts real people. Better media would help real people. Media reform means gaining the power to speak and to be heard, and that means taking some of that power from the people who have it now. So media reform is dangerous, done right. So I want to be very clear. I want truly democratic media because 45 million Americans don't have health insurance, and a lot of them think it's their fault. I want democratic media because black and brown kids go to jail because of what somebody read in the newspaper about super predators. I want truly democratic media because public television just said that a family with lesbian mothers is unfit to be acknowledged on the network that you and I pay for. And I want truly democratic media because if we had it, tens of thousands, perhaps 100,000 people who have died in Iraq might be alive today. Media reform is not an academic exercise. It's a crucial problem for our time, and asking ourselves media reform for what will help us keep our eyes on what we are ultimately fighting for. And I think it will also remind us to acknowledge and celebrate the real concrete successes that we will no doubt achieve on our way towards our bigger goals. So enjoy yourselves this weekend. I could go on more, don't tempt me with that. You're going to hear this weekend about lots of different ways to get involved, and I want to stress that none of them is better than any of the others. Some of them are local, some of them are national, some are more about structure, some are more about content. The point is what engages you, and that's what you have to keep in mind. My husband always talks about a big rock. We're trying to move a big rock. There's lots of handholds on that rock. There's lots of places to put your hand on it, and we need all of them.
Janine Jackson of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, as we turn now to Malkia Cyril, Director of the Youth Media Council.
For many of us, media reform is more than a fight for our media. It is a fight for our lives. As we've already heard, we face today a Bush-led war on the world with hundreds of thousands of deaths and even more dangerous times ahead. Our media system represents a crisis of democracy for the vast majority of the population. Our communication rights are one of the many civil rights being rolled back, but not without a fight. From state to state, communities refuse to give up their right to equal media access, fair, accurate, and balanced content, and the power to own and control media infrastructure. From alternative media and public television to cable access, ethnic press, and low-power FM, marginalized communities require a movement that demands telecommunications policies in our interests. When we speak of media reform, the intentions of the quote-unquote framers and constitutional interpretations offer incomplete answers to the questions, what is a free press and how is it guaranteed? We've heard that Jefferson and Madison understood the importance of an astute press in creating the foundation for a strong democracy and protection against elite rule. What remains both invisible and undeniable in the debate about U.S. media is the colonial context of its birth. As the founding fathers were documenting their concept of a free press, they were also building a slaveholding capitalist economy and a white nationalist politic that would entrench media policies and practices for centuries to come. Our current media system reproduces and maintains the colonial power relationships of its beginnings. Understanding the role media plays in creating and perpetuating structural racism and class oppression is not a secondary issue. It is central to building an effective and relevant movement for media reform that fundamentally transforms the U.S. system of communications. By adopting raced, classed, and gendered lens to examine issues of media content, access, and infrastructure, we can dispel three dangerous myths. The first myth is that the U.S. media used to be more democratic and has become less so over time. The fact is, the U.S. media was born of colonial conquest and imperial intrusion, calling the democratic foundations of this press into direct question. For people of color, women, queer people, and young folks, there has never been a free press, and without racial, economic, and gender justice, there never will be. The second myth is that communication rights are inherently individual civil rights guaranteed by citizenship. But what of the millions of undocumented people forced by economic and political conditions to emigrate to this country? What of the millions of incarcerated men, women, and children whose citizenship rights are severed by confinement? What of the black, brown, female, queer, and young people whose basic civil rights require ongoing movements to secure and even then are always in question? Where there is no real mechanism to guarantee civil rights, citizenship offers no protection or guarantee of communication rights. The third and final myth we must dismantle is that we can achieve a free press without also working to end racism, sexism, and class oppression. Nothing could be further from the truth. Before the current trends of consolidation, re-regulation in the corporate interest, and corporate control, the media was simultaneously a tool for civic engagement and a threat to the life and liberty of marginalized communities and remains so today. In a free market society organized by class, race, and gender, no press can be truly free unless the people who use it and are impacted by it are also free. If we want to bring about real change, the media reform movement must adopt a movement-building analysis, change model, and vision that centers racial, economic, and gender justice. Media justice is a framework for media policy change that seeks to expose structural racism and class oppression in our media system, use local organizing campaigns to root our victories, develop marginalized communities as media activists and leaders, and build an expansive movement for communication rights. We want accountability, alternatives, and a media reform movement that spins on an axis of self-determination and strategic alliance. As a member of the growing media justice movement, we at the Youth Media Council believe there are five strategic steps we can take to build an effective movement for media justice. 1, connect media policy to racial justice. 2, use content battles, access fights, and media accountability campaigns to engage new constituencies in the fight for progressive media policy. 3, organize and coordinate from the ground up. 4, use key political moments as strategic opportunities to advance our media policy agenda. Like many of you, we are working to build infrastructure, base, and leaders at the local level to challenge the Bush administration's imminent attack on the 1996 Telecommunications Act. In partnership with Media Alliance and others, we will use the upcoming broadcast license renewal process to challenge corporate control of our airwaves, increase accountability on local radio stations, confront structural racism in the licensing process, and lay the foundation for national opposition to Bush's plan. It is our turn now. It is our time. Marginalized communities care about media reform because our lives and our freedom are at stake. We care because from hip-hop to advertising, media corporations stereotype and exploit the culture of youth and people of color for profit, while those same corporations use our families to create and assemble the technology that makes them rich. We care because our communities remain producers and consumers of a media system over which they have little to no control. But powerlessness is another dangerous myth we must dismantle. Together, we have the combined strategy and skill to dismantle and rebuild this media system. Where the U.S. has used our media to export racism, sell war, and destructively declare itself a singular superpower, the problem of the U.S. media is a problem for the entire world. If I didn't say it before, let me say it now. Victory is imminent. In fact, it is everywhere. From the accountability campaign against Hot 97 in New York, to the Miami-based Democracy Workers Fight for Low Power FM. Marginalized communities are here as stakeholders, as organizers, and as visionaries. A truly free press is our right, and we're damn sure gonna fight for it.
Malkia Cyril. She's director of the Youth Media Council, speaking at the National Conference on Media Reform in St. Louis. And again today, the House Appropriations Committee is scheduled to vote on drastic cuts to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And that does it for today's program. Today, I'll be at the Fort Worth Convention Center in Texas for the annual convention of the National Association of Hispanic Journalists, talking about reclaiming our nation's media and policies. And on Saturday at the Clearwater Festival at Croton-on-Hudson at Croton Point Park at 1:50 in the afternoon. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Jeremy Scahill, Nell Geiser, and Maddie Harper. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. Our website is democracynow.org. You can go there for our headlines and our media alerts, as well as transcripts and Spanish translations of our stories, all transcripts of the broadcast are there. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us for another edition of Democracy Now!